Well, welcome everybody to this week's NPR Science Podcast. I'm Joe Palca. We have an interesting lineup this week. We'll be taking a look at just how well researchers are measuring the damage caused by the BP oil spill. Then there's a story about new tools that could help detect brain disorders in children. Then there's something on the waning of wind power in the United States. You know, I kind of wish it's not the worldwide waning of wind power. That would be much nicer. And finally, the last piece in our series, The Human Edge, that takes a look at evolution and culture. It's one of my favorite stories, and the reason for that will soon become obvious. But first, much of the scientific effort in the aftermath of the BP spill has focused on how much oil is in the Gulf and where it is. Biologists also want to know how that oil might affect marine life over the long term. As NPR's Christopher Joyce reports, some scientists say they're puzzled by the lack of an organized research effort to measure the damage.
After the BP well blew up and jettisoned some 200 million gallons of oil into the Gulf, Moat Marine Laboratory in Florida became a refuge for endangered sea turtles. The Unified Command Team in the Gulf, BP and the federal government, rescued the turtles and cleaned them up. They sent them to Moat to recuperate. Biologists there wanted to know if and how the oil might have affected the turtles. John Reynolds, director of marine mammal and sea turtle research, was one of those scientists.
Tissue samples can be acquired, but Unified Command governs how those tissue samples are used, by whom, and then apparently owns the data and all the information. And that ownership may last through all litigation. It may last decades.
Frustrating?
Of course it's frustrating.
Other marine scientists say they share Reynolds' frustration. They know that some scientific data on the effects of the spill may become evidence in court, and they're not sure how to proceed. The government is conducting something called a natural resource damage assessment. It paves the way for recovering damages from BP in court. But the assessment comes with rules on how to conduct research, and many scientists say they don't know the rules or who's in charge. Christopher Dahlia is dean of the Coast and Environment School at Louisiana State University.
I am a little mystified that there hasn't been a broader scientific discussion led by the federal government to try to scope out where there is good, strong knowledge and where there is need for more information.
Last week, federal agencies convened meetings across the Gulf with scientists to focus on tracking the remaining oil. But Dahlia says the feds are behind the curve on long-term biological effects.
It's like 4 months after the murders occurred, you know, and the body's decayed and the dogs have walked off with the bones. So it's really hard to solve the mystery under those circumstances. Science planning has not been good at all.
Assessing the damage to the Gulf will be an expensive undertaking. So far, the National Science Foundation has spent over $17 million to get biologists out into the Gulf. BP has provided about $30 million to universities and research institutes. This is a start, but not nearly enough. And good research takes more than money. William Hogarth, who's dean of the College of Marine Science at the University of South Florida, says scientists need to agree on what they're measuring and how to measure it.
So that what's done off of Louisiana waters will be compatible to what we do in Florida waters. There won't be any, well, you're comparing apples and oranges. We want to compare apples and apples.
Apples in this case being things like chemical or physical signs of oil in water, or genetic damage to fish, or oil's effect on coral reproduction. If scientists measure effects in different ways, the results might not be compatible. Stephen Murawski, the scientist organizing research for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, says following the rules for the damage assessment takes time. He acknowledges the government has not communicated as much as many scientists would like.
You know, we're trying to balance the need for the public's desire for almost complete transparency at timescales that are almost unrealistic with our fiduciary responsibility to recover natural resource damages for the country.
Murawski says NOAA is moving toward a study that will examine the effects on the entire sweep of marine life in the Gulf. In the meantime, he says scientists funded by the government can discuss and publish their results, but if they take BP money for that research, they will not be asked to testify in court on behalf of the government. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Doctors can easily tell whether a child's body is growing normally, but they have a much harder time assessing the brain. Now scientists say they found a way to use a type of MRI scan to determine a child's brain age. The technique could help identify children with developmental problems and may also help explain what goes wrong in disorders, including autism. NPR's John Hamilton reports.
A lot of kids who have severe problems with behavior or learning get brain scans. But Nico Dussenbach of Washington University in St. Louis says most of those scans don't reveal much.
We usually get a structural MRI on them just to make sure there's nothing really striking, and they usually read the scan as normal.
That's because the problem isn't usually with the brain structures themselves. Instead, the trouble comes from the way those structures are communicating with each other. In typical kids, certain connections in the brain grow stronger over time, while others are pruned away. But that process seems to get delayed or derailed in children with autism and some other developmental disorders. So Dussenbach and a team of researchers have been experimenting with a type of MRI that offers a detailed picture of communication networks in the brain. It's called functional connectivity MRI and can be done in about 5 minutes. Children don't have to perform any mental tasks. They just rest in the scanner.
We try to find which parts of the brain preferentially talk to which other parts. And we can sort of map that out. And then at the end, it essentially spits out a number that says, what is your maturity level, or what is your, you could call it a brain age.
The brain age scale was derived from scans of more than 200 people between 7 and 30. All of them had typical brain development. Dussenbach says the technique should be able to detect many children with problems including autism or attention deficit disorder. For example, he says, say a child's connectivity scan shows a brain age of 8.
Now, if they're actually 15, you'd probably start to worry that maybe something isn't going right, and you could then use that as a warning flag to dig deeper into what might be going wrong in development in this individual.
Scientists say the technique may be especially important for understanding autism. Ralph Axel Mueller is a psychologist who studies autism at San Diego State University.
In many respects, the brain of a child or adolescent with autism looks somewhat immature.
Mueller has done several studies of children with autism using functional connectivity MRI, and he says those studies suggest a pattern. Overall, he says, important connections in the brains of these children seem to be a bit weaker. But he says the scans show that these brains also retain lots of extra connections, the type that usually get pruned away.
So the reason why these networks don't function as well as in the typically developing brain seems to be more the fact that there are these abnormal retained connections all over the place.
Mueller says it's not clear whether functional connectivity scans will be able to spot signs of trouble in infants, whose brain networks have just begun to develop. But he says the technique may finally offer scientists a better way to study autism in older children.
I think functional connectivity can tell us a lot about the brain mechanisms that ultimately explain why children and adolescents with autism behave in the way they do.
The new research appears in the journal Science. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Wind power seems like an obvious answer to the world's energy needs. Put up a turbine and off you go. But wind power as a renewable energy source is sputtering. Last year, 10,000 megawatts of wind power were brought online in the United States. But as NPR's Jeff Brady reports, this year that number likely will fall by more than half.
Out on the windy plains of eastern Colorado, Canadian company Enbridge recently held an event hosted by Senior Vice President Jim Schultz.
It's my great pleasure to welcome you all to our groundbreaking celebration for the 250-megawatt Cedar Point Wind Energy Project.
Wind power advocates wish more ceremonies like this were happening around the country. 2010 will mark the first time in 6 years that this industry's growth rate will actually decline. There are several reasons for this, but probably the biggest factor has to do with government incentives. The wind industry typically rises and falls with the passing and expiration of federal tax credits. Look at a graph of wind turbine installations, and there's a sawtooth pattern.
sometimes high, then they drop off, then they're high, then they drop off.
George Sturzinger heads the Renewable Energy Policy Project in Washington. He says wind farms are expensive to build. When the credit markets dried up in 2008, so did the money for new projects. The White House and Congress threw the industry a lifeline in the stimulus package 18 months back in the form of investment tax credits. Right now, if you build a wind project, the government will essentially cut you a check for 30% of the cost. But that lifeline is running out of rope and scheduled to expire at the end of this year. Sturzinger says that deadline prompted a lot of activity last year.
Everybody moved their projects forward into 2009 to take advantage of it. Now people are looking at, you know, can you make it for sure by that deadline? If not, you stop.
And wait for the next government incentive to come along. Another factor at work here is the price of natural gas. It's relatively cheap now, so some utilities are choosing to build gas power plants rather than wind farms. In response, the wind industry says it needs a federal mandate, a law that would tell those utilities they have to buy more renewable forms of energy. Denise Bode is CEO of the American Wind Energy Association.
We're kind of stuck without that long-term policy in place that sends the signal to the utilities that they need to purchase wind as part of a diversified portfolio and not just depend on traditional fossil fuels for 70% of their electricity.
President Obama has said he supports a renewable energy mandate. Getting it passed this fall is one of the wind industry's priorities as lawmakers return to Capitol Hill. It's worth stressing that we're talking about a decline in growth here. That means the wind industry is still growing this year, just not as fast as last year or the year before that. Matt Rogers was appointed to oversee stimulus projects at the Department of Energy. He says despite the blip this year, the big picture looks good.
We are well on our way to doubling U.S. renewable generation capacity in the U.S., which is what the president had committed to. So we're pretty excited about the overall pace of development.
The question now is whether that pace can be maintained. Roger says it would help to have more certainty when it comes to tax policy and other incentives. That would give investors and wind energy developers the information they need to make long-term plans instead of waiting around for the next government lifeline. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
And finally, a really, really interesting story by NPR's Joe Palca. Oh, that's me. You maybe remember that throughout this summer, we've been airing stories about how human beings came to be the dominant species in a series we call The Human Edge. The final installment of that series asks the question, where do we go from here? There are no specific answers, of course, but humans are in the unique position of being able to shape a future of our own choosing. To understand what I mean by that, you'll have to take a trip with me to Fairbanks, Alaska. You can tell when summer is ending in Fairbanks, Alaska. Sandhill cranes fly over on their way south for the winter.
When the cranes show up, it's when all of these guys go into rut.
These guys are a half dozen or so 700-pound muskox covered in long, dark hair. Biologist Perry Barboza is standing near a paddock at the Large Animal Research Station, a part of the University of Alaska. The cranes can't take the winters here. The muskox don't seem to mind at all.
They have a very, very super fine sort of wool that's underneath this long skirt of hair. And that provides them enormous amounts of insulation. And on top of that, beneath that, they have about 2 inches of fat as well.
An exquisite adaptation for a long, lean winter. But a disaster in the heat. Put a muskox on a plane to, say, Dubai on the Arabian Peninsula.
They'd die almost as soon as they got to Dubai, because they cannot dump heat.
Muskox can only survive in one kind of environment. And that, along with a few other cosmetic details, is what makes humans different from muskox.
What we're able to do that other animals aren't able to do is to rapidly adapt to completely new environments.
Robert Boyd is an anthropologist at the University of California, Los Angeles. Humans can live anywhere they like, in Fairbanks, where the winters get to 40 below, or Dubai, where the summers are routinely 100 above.
Most animals all animals except humans would have to adapt to that by changing genetically.
And that usually takes millions of years or more. But we can adapt to widely varying environments with hardly any genetic changes at all. In fact, just 10 or 15,000 years after leaving Africa, the earliest modern humans started showing up near the Arctic, and not just paying a visit, but living there.
Humans adapt by learning things, passing those things on. The next generation learns something more, and on timescales that are long by the standards of a human lifetime, but really short compared to what is normal for genetic change.
So instead of growing insulating wool or adding an inch or two of fat, the first humans to move to the Arctic adapted by using their wits. They learned to sew.
You could say that one of the most important tools for surviving in the North is the needle.
Aaron Kroll is Alaska director of the Smithsonian's Arctic Study Center. We're standing in front of a display case filled with clothing in the Anchorage Museum. There are warm fur coats and waterproof sealskin boots. These garments aren't very old, but there's good reason to believe they aren't all that different from what Alaska's first humans were wearing thousands of years ago.
Let's take a look at this garment here.
Kroll points to a parka made from seal intestines, a thin material that looks a bit like ripstop nylon.
This one has a hood. They have drawstrings around the hood and the sleeves. And for hunters who are out in kayaks, they also often have drawstrings around the bottom that you would tie around the cockpit of the boat.
Eskimos don't have a gene that tells them how to make a parka or build a kayak. That ability comes from cultural knowledge passed from generation to generation. Sure, we needed to evolve a brain that could conceive of the idea of a kayak or a waterproof parka, but UCLA's Rob Boyd says having a big brain is just the start.
It's easy to see that it's not individual intelligence that makes us so good at adapting. It's an important component, but we also need this ability to accumulate knowledge gradually over a whole population of people over hundreds or maybe even thousands of years.
Boyd says consider what happened to the Franklin expedition. Two ships set out from England on May 19, 1845 in search of the Arctic Northwest Passage. Neither returned. Almost 15 years after the expedition set off, a search party found a single sheet of paper left in a tin can covered by stones in the Canadian Arctic.
May 1847. Wintered at Beechey Island, ascended Wellington Channel, and returned by west side of Cornwallis Island. Sir John Franklin commanding the expedition. All's well.
But scribbled in the margins of the paper, a more ominous note.
Sir John Franklin died on the 11th of June, 1847, and the total loss by deaths in the expedition has been, to this date, 9 officers and 15 men.
In the end, all perished, but not before the starving crew apparently resorted to cannibalism. Boyd says the irony is that there were Canadian Eskimos living near where the ships became frozen in the ice, and the Eskimos survived the harsh winter just fine.
The difference was the English sailors didn't have the knowledge necessary to live in the Arctic, and they couldn't figure it out on their own.
For the last 10,000 years, it's largely been cultural changes that have shaped how humans have evolved and cope with their environments, not genetic changes. And just as geneticists have been looking at ancient DNA to see how new genes emerged and spread, anthropologists and archaeologists are trying to do the same for the emergence and transmission of new skills.
This is the campus site, found in the 1930s on University of Alaska Fairbanks campus.
Archaeologist Ben Potter and I are standing on some steps leading down from the modern university campus. Around us are trees, but at the bottom of the hill, the trees disappear and a vast, flat plain stretches off to the horizon. This is a great spot for watching planes coming into the Fairbanks Airport. Thousands of years ago, it would have had other attractions.
So certainly it would be a nice overlook for looking for game.
A herd of reindeer would be easy to spot from here.
We know they were butchering animals here. We do find bison, hare. I think they have some beaver as well.
The kinds of stone tools and spear points found at this site begin to explain how Alaska's first human settlers became efficient hunters. Potter spends a lot of time visiting ancient sites like this one. He says you can think of them like a laboratory.
An extremely important laboratory to understand how humans, when they're pushed to their limit or when they're approaching an environment that they're essentially not equipped biologically for. How did that happen?
10,000 years ago, the latest developments in arrowheads or stone microblades would have been passed from parent to child or tribe to tribe. Now, the way cultural information is transmitted has changed dramatically. UCLA's Rob Boyd says today there are institutions whose whole function is to be engaged in cultural transmission.
Schools, religious institutions and associations, and then there are things like NPR who are in the business of transmitting to zillions of people.
There's a torrent of cultural knowledge flowing over us all the time, and we get to decide how to use that knowledge to shape our future.
Where it's going to go, you know, your guess is as good as mine.
Well, wherever it goes, if we don't like the outcome, we'll only have ourselves to blame. That series, The Human Edge, was produced by Jane Greenhalgh and Rebecca Davis and edited by Allison Richards. And that's it for this week's On Science. We'll be back again next week. Thanks very much for listening. I'm Joe Palca.